Today, is it time for a new political voice? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics World, Nugget's Post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Victor Klein. Hello, Victor.
Hello, Martin. How are you?
Yeah, great. And thank you very much for coming on and spending some time with me. Now, this is important news because you have decided that the political system in Australia needs a bit of a shake-up.
We have, yes, absolutely.
Now, tell me a little bit then about the new party and also a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, the party started quite small, just a few friends who, you know, we were just sitting around drinking red wine and bitching about, you know, a corrupt government and a useless opposition and what will we do about it and, you know, how could we do anything about it? And Catherine said, well, you know, we're old enough and ugly enough, we actually can do something about it. And we said, we? You mean we, literally us? And she said, yes. And the party went from there. I think it has taken off enormously. I'm getting, at the moment, in the last week, particularly because of certain tweets I've made about a prosecution we're launching against a certain government minister, something like 2 million views on Twitter. So in a short space of just over a year, and I think that's happened because the same desperation that drove us to form a new party is the same desperation that's felt by large numbers of the Australian population.
And let's just be clear about the name of the party.
Yeah, so the party's called the New Liberals. And we took that name because as we were talking, we knew, knowing each other as we do, that the party that we would form would be a liberal party. A true liberal party, as that word is understood around the world and has been for 200 years, to mean a party that believes in equality of opportunity, compassion, justice, and freedom, but also a strong place for government to ensure that in exercising that freedom, the individual doesn't impinge on the freedom of others. It's that old saying, you know, my right to swing my fist in the air stops at your face. You know, so we're not libertarians. The libertarians would say, I can swing my fist anywhere. If I hit anything, that's my business, you know. So I guess the classic example I always give is if we were in government and a multinational said we want to come and trade in your country, we'd say, of course, you're free to trade in our country. But if you, in the process, pay no tax, and therefore literally impinge on the freedom of every other Australian taxpayer, then we're going to step in. We have a right and a duty to step in as a government and do something about that. So that was the party we formed, and we said that we knew that given that we have a Liberal Party, the Liberal Party of Australia in government, and given that we knew that they had really, I mean, there's no other way to say it, but perverted the word liberal to mean its exact opposite of ultra-conservative, because whatever liberal means, and it has several meanings as people understand it, what it doesn't mean is ultra-conservative. It means the polar opposite of ultra-conservative. But, of course, people have been trained up in this country in the last 20 or 30 years to think that that's what liberal means. So we knew that we would be buying into trouble by putting the word liberal in our name, but we had promised ourselves that we would tell the truth in all things so as to distinguish ourselves from the crooks that we were trying to replace. And so we thought if we balk at telling the truth at this first hurdle, naming ourselves, then what are we going to do after that? So that's how we came about. That's how we got our name, and that's how we are where we are.
Yeah, well, we'll talk a little bit later about plans and, you know, timing and things. But let me touch on this, because there are a set of values implicit in what you've said. And it really begs the question, what is society for? What is it about, right? And how do we actually measure success of society?
Yes, well, I don't think we measure it by GDP, for a start. We measure it by, well, as someone once said, you measure it by how well the least fortunate are doing in your society. And we see the purpose of government is to create the best possible situation for the largest number of people. And one brings to bear the economic tools and all the other tools of government to achieve that. That's not what's being done at the moment. The insistence on the neoclassical economic model over the last 30 or 40 years has resulted in a very sad Australia that doesn't resemble the Australia I grew up in at all. It's an Australia where 3 million people are below the poverty line. Young people have no chance of buying a house. The same young people have to scratch together a living doing four different jobs in the so-called gig economy. By the way, wonderful use of neoclassical economists have a great ability to pick, to frame the debate. You call it a gig economy, it sounds like it's fun, you know. Well, it's not fun for those people doing their four jobs and still earning less than what I earned, you know, when I first came out of university. So we want to turn all that around. Economically, we want to, I mean, we say that we are really the true inheritors of the Menzies tradition. Now, there are a lot of things about Robert Menzies that we don't like and we don't follow, but certainly in an economic sense, that Keynesian sense of giving priority to real full employment, and by real full employment, I mean, you know, something like 1.2, 1.4%, not this crazy situation that we've been induced to believe that 5% is full employment. And in fact, it's actually 15% because the other 10% are working 1 hour a week, and that's counted as employment, you know. So we want to get back to that whatever Menzies' motives were and whatever drove him to do what he did, he sought full employment, he obtained full employment. By and large, he kept inflation under control, and there were some beggars in the street, but they were usually alcoholics, you know. They weren't 50-year-old mothers who, you know, have been executives and lost their job and have to live out of their cars and take a shower down by the beach, which is what one woman who came to us told us about, you know, and she's not untypical, I think. But that's what we want to reverse, and that's what we see the purpose of government being. Not to drive all income and profit to the top 1%.
Right, and I was going to say, there's a very different theme coming through here compared with what I call the neoliberal philosophy, right, which is basically wealth rises to the top and to the 1%. It's very much debt-driven. It's very much private sector-led. And my view is that that philosophy, which is really contaminating many Western countries and Western thinking more generally, has really led to huge inequalities and inefficiencies in our economy, and the economy really, which isn't fit for purpose.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Absolutely.
So in terms of trying to take that story forward, one of the critical questions I have is the importance of small business inside the economy, because if you look at all the investment that's been made from government, you know, even through the stimulus, it was all thrown at the big end of town pretty much, you know, and they probably didn't need it in the first place. But certainly in my surveys, I see a lot of issues with the engine of the economy, the small business sector, not actually being able to get a fair go and to be able to do the things they want to do. So what's your perspective in terms of the importance of the small business sector?
I'm probably not qualified enough to compare the value of the small business sector to the value of the large business sector. But just logically and intuitively, I think all sectors should be in balance, and all sectors should be functioning properly and in a healthy way. If the small business sector atrophies to the benefit of the multinationals, I think we all know that's not going to be a good thing. I run a small business in the sense that, you know, my wife and I have a company, for the law reporting work that I do, just for example, and we are so burdened with regulation, it takes, I don't know how long it takes us, but it takes us a lot of time, to get through that. And I hear small business talking about that all the time. Regulation's fine for large corporations because they've got plenty of money and plenty of people to look after that for them. But if you're a two-person company, or, you know, a plumbing or a law reporting company, and it's you and your partner, I mean, it's very, very difficult. I find it ironic. I know this much, that the Liberal Party government claims to be a government for small business, and they're anything but. And I think people need to know that that's not happening. I mean, with our job guarantee scheme, we're very keen to, you know, make jobs available to everybody to get above to get those 3 million people who are below the poverty line above the poverty line and get them work. And we know that the minimum JGS salary that we will guarantee, which will probably be somewhere around the median wage, will set a de facto minimum wage, and that if the private sector wants to get those people to come and work for them, which we think they will because the JGS will stimulate the economy, then they have to pay more, and that will be a de facto redistribution of wealth. But I'm very keen to find a way to make sure that that doesn't further punish the small business. You know, I'm not sure how to achieve that at the moment, and I've got to take advice.
Yes, well, it's a very interesting.
Sorry, we've got some people like Steve Keyes, you know, who do know what they're talking about, and he might be able to help. And maybe you
said. Absolutely. Well, you know, the perspective I have is having surveyed small businesses for more than 20 years is that the gradient uphill just to keep the business running has never been steeper. The amount of hurdles you have to jump through have never been higher. And the difficulty of getting finance to be able to do things is almost impossible. So many are really up against it. And, you know, for my mind, this is one of the core economic growth engines of the economy. And we're just not investing in the right areas. Whereas the big end of town, quite often those entities which will be owned partly by overseas investors, you know, may be doing fine. Many of them, of course, got some significant handouts through the COVID cycle, right? So there's this massive latent potential down in small business land, which you know, I keep bumping up against, thinking surely policymakers can see that it's not working.
Okay, I know this is an interview where you ask me questions, but I'd love to ask you what you thought the solution for that would be, assuming we're in government and assuming we're very much, you know, MMT advocates and so on. Would it simply be a question of investing in some form in those?
So I think there are three things. The first is we need to actually take some of the regulatory controls away, make it simpler to do things, right? Big end of town, you actually need bigger regulation, but it's got to be right for size, right, which it isn't. The second is many businesses cannot get the funding to be able to do the things that they need. We need an innovation fund. Yes. My own view is that should probably be a public bank rather than a private sector bank. So a bank that's specifically set up to be able to actually inject funding into small business in particular. Right. The third is we've got to have this roadmap so that small businesses can grow into bigger businesses.
Yes.
And in fact, if you talk to a lot of small businesses, that they can just about hang on by being really small, but when they try and expand and accelerate, they hit so many barriers from funding and regulation. In fact, a number of people that I've interviewed in the last year or so have given up and said, we've got this great idea, it's proven to be powerful, but we cannot take it forward in Australia. We have to go to the US or we have to go to Europe simply because the market is more able to help us there than here. So we have to change some of those settings, in my view, to be able to actually make small businesses the powerful growth engine it can be. And then, as you say, it can create more jobs and deliver the sorts of jobs that people want. And by the way, the other point is most small businesses cannot at the moment afford to train people. So there's a whole training education piece of this as well. Yeah. And again, I think that's something else that from a policy perspective could make a huge difference. You know, I could go on at this for a long, long time because I've looked at it for a long, long time. But this is, for me, one of the critical weak points in our economy at the moment.
Oh, it sounds absolutely perfect to me. I don't think there'd be a soul inside our party that would object to one thing you just said. It's probably something that we've overlooked. I mean, we do have a policy for a public bank, but to use it for those purposes rather than just for the individuals makes absolute sense for me.
Well, I guess another thing that hasn't made a lot of sense to me is housing policy in Australia, right? So yes. We've got the situation. There's a report that came out a couple of weeks ago talking about the elephant in the room, which was basically trampling the whole of the economy. The housing sector is now sort of pretty much everything. Banks are lending most of their finances for housing. Housing affordability is, you know, still very, very bad. The proportion of people who own their own properties compared with 20 years ago is going down, right? Yeah. It has failed us.
Yes.
So what's your perspective on housing and you know, what are the things that you're thinking about in terms of trying to address some of those critical issues?
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy and it's sad. And, you know, we're as you may know, we're working with Professor Stephen Keen, who's our senior policy advisor on economics, towards a solution for this. And it comes out of the solution that we have settled on, but he's in the process of drafting that up in a logical and readable fashion, it comes out of his debt jubilee idea. And the idea would be that we would pay down part of the mortgage on current households, which would bring, taking the heat out of the credit that goes into housing, would bring down the price of housing by an equivalent amount. The upshot would be that the current homeowners would have the same equity, would pay off their houses quicker, and the house would be probably $200,000 cheaper for those trying to enter the market for the first time. And at the very least, it would call a halt to this insanity we see where every morning you get up and, you know, house prices in your area are, you know, another $10,000. It's crazy, and it can't. I mean, you would be able to comment on this better than me. But if we don't do that, or something like that, aren't we heading for just unbelievable disaster somewhere down the track?
Well, it's already happening. So, you know, my mortgage stress data showing that we've got 41% of households with cash flow issues with their mortgage at the moment, right?
Yep.
Despite the official figures looking remarkable. New people buying a property today with a mortgage, are on average getting a loan that's 15% bigger than it was a year ago. And it's interesting that Philip Lowe yesterday in one of his press conferences after the announcement yesterday said he's worried about house prices accelerating faster than wages. Like, that's a new thought. You go back 10 years, right? It was happening then as well. So it's been happening on his watch. So unfortunately, to my mind, the Reserve Bank and APRA and the government are part of the problem rather than being part of the solution to this.
Absolutely.
Right? And it's almost like, I read an article the other day saying it's like in New Zealand. New Zealand economy is a housing market plus a little bit of the economy bolted on the side. It's a bit like we're transforming to in Australia as well, because so much of the bank lending is for housing. So much of it is not affordable. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, people haven't realised this, if you're spending less on your mortgage repayments, you'll be able to spend more on other things. And therefore, you can actually create a greater momentum in the economy, which means that you can actually get better growth that way. So you don't have to rely just on ever higher house prices.
Well, it's a con job by the banks, isn't it? I mean, it's as simple as that.
Well, certainly their balance sheets are bigger than ever before. And, of course, they can pass those profits back to shareholders, going back to our neoliberal point earlier on. Mm. But it's not productive lending, right?
It's not
productive to the broader economy.
And
so essentially what you have is more and more of economic activity being sucked into the black hole of housing rather than actually investing in small business, as we discussed earlier, right? So there is the point is there are choices here. And then the other point I'd make, I think, if I was thinking about housing, is there's also a social housing question as well, right? We are not actually providing the housing route to those people who can't actually jump into the private sector. And I think that's another issue which has been dropped by governments for at least a decade and probably longer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, that results in that homelessness that I was talking about before. And, you know, this neoclassical idea that's been run for the last 40 years that if you don't have a job, it's your fault. You know, when you look at that woman that we met, I always talk about her because she had such a powerful influence. Well, not that I didn't know about this before, but, you know, when you come face to face with a highly articulate, intelligent ex-executive, 50 years of age, you know, who is living out of her car, you know, I mean, that's not a person who doesn't want a job. That's not some lazy dull bludger.
And that's, of course, the point, because essentially those people who are, you know, out of the system, unemployed or whatever, right, are in the current philosophy, you know, pushed over to the edge of society. It's their fault. They're not doing the right thing. You know, they should go find a job or whatever, right? Yeah. And unfortunately, that is not getting to the root cause issues, just like mental health, right? So people yes. now say, oh, you've got mental health issues, because they can privatise the problem, right? It's yes. in your head rather than actually being created by the way that the economy has yeah. been working. So these are fundamentally important yeah. issues, I think.
Well, it's amazed me since I was a child. I could see how illogical it was to suggest that, you know, at one point there's 1.2% of people, and maybe, you know, and that's the mismatch of geography and so on. But, you know, there's going to be some lazy people in there who don't want a job. But let's assume the whole 1.2% don't want a job. And then suddenly, 20 years later, 15% have become lazy, you know, and don't want a job and won't try and find one. The logic of that, the illogicality of that didn't escape me as a 10-year-old, you know, and yet it's successfully peddled now.
Well, let's talk about peddling and mm-hmm. talk about political culture, right? Because yeah. we've seen a particular style of cultural debate, political debate in recent times, political behaviour, the pork barrelling, you know, the car parks and the sports rorts and all those things. What's your perspective in terms of the current political norms, and what would you do differently?
Well, everything. You know, absolutely everything. So what you've got, well, if you look back to a previous time, let's say a government decided that they wanted to engage in 904 acts of immorality, unethical behaviour and straight out illegality. And I say 904 because of that wonderful document that the Chasers produced where they listed 904 examples. If a government tried to do that, there would be a vociferous opposition who would be damning them and screaming at them across the table at question time. And then there would be a robust press who would report what the opposition was saying. And the government wouldn't get three crooked acts into their 904. But, you know, and they'd probably get thrown out. But we have now a normalisation of criminality. I mean, I don't hesitate to say that much of the front bench of the current government are criminals. They do things. I mean, if you take, for example, and there are many, many examples, if you take, for example, Angus Taylor buying, Barnaby Joyce, sorry, buying water on privatised water, by the way, don't get me started, but Barnaby Joyce buys water on the open market for the Australian government from Angus Taylor, his co-minister, at twice the market price. And, of course, Angus Taylor then sends it offshore so he doesn't have to pay any tax in it. Now, if you were a company director, if you were a company director who bought property on behalf of the company from a co-director at twice the market price, you would be in jail, you know. But if a government minister does it with another government minister now, you're called the Honourable Mr. Joyce, the Honourable Mr. Taylor, you know. It's horrible. And then in the heart of all this, Anthony Albanese stands up and says, well, I don't know of any corruption in Parliament. Now, does he say that because he's a fool? Does he say that because he's terrified? Does he say that because he, like the government, has been bought and paid for by corporate interests and the Murdoch media? I don't know. I don't care. It's pathetic. So if you have a corrupt government, no opposition and no media reporting on it, then you'd have two possibilities here. One possibility is that you just proceed down that path and become a totally authoritarian state. And there are people in this government who would love that to happen. Or there is a grassroots movement that rises up, takes advantage of the dying embers of a democratic system, and eventually manages to overturn it and throw them out. And we, along with a lot of people in those voices of independence movements, are trying to make it the latter, because we are absolutely convinced that if we don't, it will be the former. Yeah.
And thinking, you know, further on that theme, the public servants who, you know, a decade, two decades, three decades ago would have been, you know, ideological neutral, very objective in terms of what they actually advocate, also seem to have now been sucked into the same story.
Absolutely. Why it's so close, why it is within a pip of authoritarianism, is because people have been tamed, and the media has been tamed, either because Murdoch has 70 or 80% of the newspapers, or the ABC people are afraid of losing their funding, or the few remaining newspapers that aren't in those two categories are afraid of being either sued or raided or arrested, as we saw with Friendly Geordies the other day, and other people, or put on some sort of secret trial for breaching some sort of yet-to-be-disclosed problem, you know, like. And then the public service has become like that too. They know that their jobs are dependent. So, for example, we were challenged by the Liberal Party about our name and our right to be registered as a political party. Now, they lost that challenge, and not surprisingly, they have appealed. And the appeal goes in the first instance to an internal panel of three, and one of those panel members is the AEC commissioner himself, Tom Rogers. Now, Tom Rogers was appointed by the Abbott government in 2014 on a five-year contract, reappointed by Morrison on a five-year contract. And if he wants to be reappointed again in 2024, he needs to have the Liberal Party in power. So his position, his livelihood, and his future prospects totally depend on him finding in favour of the Liberal Party. Now, we have challenged that, and we've said he has to be disqualified from that panel. But it will be very interesting to see if he is, because, I mean, I'm hoping he is, because the head of that panel is Justice Susan Kenny, who is a wonderful judge and, you know, a truly unbiased judge as far as I know, and I hope she will deal with that in a proper way. But if she doesn't, and if he stays on that panel, I think it's a classic example of how the system is sucking the public servants as well as the media and everybody else into their little vortex of authoritarianism. And I think that, and the other aspect of the public service is, and people tell me this all the time, ex-public servants tell me this all the time, when I was there, we had a good culture. I left because I couldn't stand what was being done to the culture. So it's the old story, you know, the good people leave under that sort of regime, and you're left with the yes men and the yes women who will do whatever is necessary and who have no moral fibre to stand up to the government. Public servants, what's that wonderful phrase they're supposed to use? Without, something like without fear or favour, you know, advise without fear or favour. It's a different form of words, but I think that's disappeared from the public service. We've got someone working on a policy where we want to restore a public service that, you know, has an emphasis on the word service, because that's the other thing that's left the public service, because there's been so much privatization. I would get three or four letters or messages a day from people saying, can you please try and do something for me, because, you know, I'm on this pension or that benefit, and, you know, I'm desperate and I'm starving. And I go along and this new privatized organization tells me, you know, I haven't filled out Form X, and when I go on the website, Form X doesn't exist. And, you know, that sort of nightmare that people are being put through. And, of course, with the, you know, the debt, the robo-debt is what I'm trying to say. So all these things, yeah, it's every one of our key institutions is degraded, I think.
And would you include the RBA in that?
I'm guessing, but I don't have enough personal knowledge of what goes on inside there, and I don't have enough informants. I feel I know a lot about what's happening in the general public service. What do you think? I mean, you would have a much better idea than I.
I'm afraid that I am quite sceptical of the Reserve Bank's role. Look at the fact that they're part of what's called the Council of Financial Regulators, right?
Yes.
Which is
yes.
The Reserve Bank, Treasury, APRA and ASIC sitting around the table, right? So is that independent, right? And it seems to me that in some cases the government defers to the RBA because the RBA is doing the government's wish.
I think so, and also, sorry to interrupt, but also it occurs to me that, you know, there's, what have they got, 3 enshrined principles in legislation that they have to pursue, and one of them is full employment, and that's been absolutely forgotten. And the best you can do is people reporting that we should be grateful to the unemployed because they, you know, they keep inflation down. And we know they're suffering, but, you know, thanks, guys. And that's, so I think they've abrogated their – it'd be really interesting. It is theoretically possible to – not that I'm suggesting I would do this, but theoretically possible to launch some sort of action, legal action against the Reserve Bank or failure to pursue one of the 3 dictates of their charter.
Well, it's interesting, of course, because the Reserve Bank has very strong links with the Bank for International Settlements, which is effectively the central banker's banker, right?
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
You're seeing a replication of the same policies that we're seeing here in other countries, right?
Yeah.
And again, I come back to my earlier point, you know, it's clearly failed. We're not actually seeing the economic results that we should be seeing. We've got the, you know, the employment rate, as you say, lower, but artificially lower. We've got the economic parameters in the wrong place, and yet it's just perpetuation of the same old, same old.
Yep, absolutely.
So I guess the key question, you know, as we sort of come to the end of this initial conversation, is there's clearly a lot that needs to be changed.
Yes.
Is political change actually possible? Or are we stuck in this sort of vortex where effectively just you go round and round and round and the social media stuff goes on, but nothing actually changes?
We believe, and we have to believe, that it's possible to change because that's what we're here to do. And I think we have hit with the right platform and the right approach at the right time. And even as it turns out, the right name. So here's an example. The current government has, a 1-seat majority or 2-seat majority, something like that at the most. Now, what we're being told by our sophologists is that there are about 4 million moderate, disaffected Liberal voters around the country who hate this government, who vote for it through clenched teeth. My brother-in-law, his father was press secretary to Robert Menzies. Now, he's a big macho guy who was literally in tears before the last election saying, those bastards have stolen my party. And we're told that he's representative of about 4 million people. And what that boils down to is that in about 36 Liberal-held seats which we're going to contest, it's quite possible for us to get as much as 20% of the vote, most of which will come from those people who would never vote Labor or Greens because they're generationally and constitutionally incapable of doing it. What they're looking for is a real Liberal Party, and they go, oh, here's one, we'll vote for them. And if we do get that 20% of the vote, there is a real chance, providing that the preferences fall the right way, that we can win, theoretically, every one of those seats. Now, that's not going to happen. But all we need to do is win 3 or 4, and you're going to end up with, in all probability, a minority Labor government. Also, because if you look at the results from last time in central Melbourne, not only did Adam Bandt win Melbourne for the Greens, but there were about 4 other seats where they came so close it was just a hair's breadth. And I've spoken to some of the Labor people in Melbourne, and they say, we've lost in Melbourne and we'll never get it back. They're not even trying, you know. So you could have a situation where we got 2 or 3 seats. The Greens ended up with 4 or 5. and maybe a couple of independents still. You know, someone like Zali Steggall will probably stay there. Other people will come in because there's a Voices of movement in every electorate now, just about. And the upshot could be that you have a minority Labor government, a decimated Liberal, former Liberal government, and somewhere between three and a dozen New Liberals, Greens and Independents holding the balance of power. Now, if that happens, you know, we will make the bastards do the right thing. And if they don't, they will wither on the vine. And so I think there's a, at this moment in time, it's a crucial point in history. There is a real, real chance that this boys' club that is running the country for its own benefit, and by that I mean the duopoly, I mean the two major parties, which are virtually indistinguishable. If we can, we will either make them do their job or they will disappear. And, you know, there's plenty of examples around the world of political situations where governing parties have got so complacent and then the next thing they know, they've got wiped out. I mean, there was the Canadian example where the government ended up with, like, two seats. There's the Mark McGowan thing over in Western Australia. Macron in France swept aside four huge parties that have been around since the Franco-Prussian War. I mean, the world is ready for it, and this country is no different from any other. And as I say, so I think it's altogether possible. I don't think that's even stretching hope. I think it's a real possibility.
And do you think the media helps or hinders this sort of debate?
At the moment, they're totally hindering everything. I hate to say it, but so the classic example is we have launched, you may know, because the New South Wales Police refused to act, we have launched a private criminal prosecution against Christian Porter for rape. Now, you would think that would be a story of interest to the mainstream media. We had some small reporting of that in the Guardian and also in the Telegraph, but it got pushed into the local news, would you believe? Into the local news. Now, what's happening is 2 million views on Twitter, all over Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, every podcast and blog in the country is covering this. I even got sent something today. The American legal media is reporting it. You know? but almost nobody in the mainstream media in Australia is reporting it. Now, that can't be a help. And you wonder, how long can they hold the line on that sort of this doesn't suit the governing regime, so we can't report it attitude, be that because they're Murdoch or be that because they're ABC and worried about funding or somebody else and worried about being arrested. How long can they hold the line on that? I mean, you know, we have a team, which I'll announce soon. I'm not part of the team because I need to be able to comment. But, you know, we have a senior barrister, one of the country's most experienced solicitors, instructing that person who's our candidate for Robertson, Bunya Holt, two ex-senior sex crimes detectives working for us. Now, when he gets committed for trial, will they all still be silent? Let's say he's convicted. Will they be silent? He's sentenced to 5 years. Will they pretend that doesn't happen? Will they just report, we don't know where Christian Porter is? Isn't this funny? I mean, how long can you be obstructive to the truth? I don't know. We'll see.
It's an interesting question. And I think there are other dimensions where you could also argue that the media is not really doing the service that it should in terms of objective, independent and balanced views as to what's going on, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So as we come to the end of our conversation, Victor, where should people go if they want to find more information about the New Liberals?
Just Google the New Liberals and they'll get the website, and we've got everything there, the policies, the candidates, the national executive, our constitution, where to donate. Please go to that button, the very important button.
Terrific. Well, I really appreciate your time today. And I think for many people who've been following DFA, this will be really good news that people are beginning to wake up and think there's got to be a different model, a different way of working, because, you know, frankly, the normal course of business is just not doing it for Australia or Australians at the moment.
I couldn't agree more. And thank you very much for having me on, Martin.
I really appreciated the conversation, and I'm sure we'll talk again. Thank you.
Sure we will. Thank you.